Connecting the Dots with Dr. Wilmer Leon, where the analysis of politics, culture, and history converge.
Welcome to the Connecting the Dots podcast with Dr. Wilmer Leon, and I'm Wilmer Leon. Here's the point. We have a tendency to view current events as though they happen in a vacuum, failing to understand the broader historical context in which they occur. During each episode, my guests and I have probing, provocative, and in-depth discussions that connect the dots between current events and the broader historic context in which they happen, enabling you to better understand and analyze the events that impact the global village in which we live. On today's episode, the issue before us is, what can we expect next? Now that Iran has responded militarily to Israel's attack on the Iranian consulate in Syria. For insight into this, let's turn to my guest. He's a former U.S. Marine Corps intelligence officer who served in the former Soviet Union implementing arms control treaties in the Persian Gulf during Operation Desert Storm and in Iraq, overseeing the disarmament of WMD. His most recent book is entitled Disarmament in the Time of Perestroika. And he is, of course, Scott Ritter. As always, Scott, welcome to the Connecting the Dots podcast with Wilmer Leon.
Well, thanks for having me.
So Pepe Escobar wrote the following. He called it the shadow play. And he writes, so this is how it happened. Burns met an Iranian delegation in Oman. He was told the Israeli punishment was inevitable. And if the U.S. got involved, then all U.S. bases will be attacked and the Strait of Hormuz would be blocked. Burns said, we do nothing if no civilians are harmed. The Iranians said it will be a military base or an embassy. The CIA said, go ahead and do it. Scott Ritter, you've been writing about these issues in Iran for over 20 years. First, your assessment of Pepe Escobar's assessment.
Well, I mean, clearly Pepe is a journalist. He is a journalist of some renown, and he has a source. So, and he's reporting it. It's plausible. Mm-hmm. I can't confirm it. I can't sit right here and say, I know that this happened. I have no idea if this happened. I do know that the CIA has, over the course of time, taken on a shadow diplomacy role, because the State Department, in implementing America's hegemonic policies, has alienated America with so many nations, and that normal diplomatic relations are impossible. And so the CIA has assumed this responsibility. Indeed, this is why William Burns was selected by Joe Biden to be the director of the CIA. He's not a CIA hand. He's not a man who has involved. He's a diplomat, former ambassador to Russia. And he's a man who has written a book called The Back Channel, which describes his approach, the back channel approach to resolving things. Burns has carried out similar meetings with Russia. When trying to reopen arms control venues or talk about possible prisoner exchanges, it's Burns that takes the lead on these things. The CIA has played an important role in the past in facilitating dialogue between the Palestinians and the Israelis. The CIA had a very big role to play in making that happen. The CIA was behind the secret negotiations with the Taliban that led to the American withdrawal. So would it surprise me that the CIA has connectivity with Iran? Absolutely not, especially given Burns' role and the importance of the back channel to the Biden administration. I think the Israelis might find it somewhat of a shock that the United States greenlit the Iranian response. But then again, we're living in very strange times where the lack of, let's just call it, the deterioration of relations between the United mm-hmm. States and Israel is real. I've said for some time now that no American president or presidential candidate has won the White House by turning his back on Israel. Mm-hmm. And I've also noted that no Israeli prime minister stays in power by turning his back on the United States. And yet we have a situation today where Joe Biden, a sitting president, is starting to turn his back on Israel because of the policies of Benjamin Netanyahu's government, policies that are being carried out in direct defiance of American instructions to the contrary. So, we live in unprecedented times, and it would seem to me that the United States has made it clear that their policy objectives, strategic policy objectives, and again, just a quick background, remember, part of the reason why we withdrew from Afghanistan in August of 2021 is that we were delinking ourselves from a two-decade-long commitment to the Middle East. We were going to lower our profile there as part of our pivot to the Pacific to confront China. And so we don't have, we no longer are actively implementing the Carter-era doctrine of guaranteed American military intervention anytime something in the Middle East goes south that we don't like. We don't do Desert Storm anymore. We don't do Operation Iraqi Freedom anymore. We don't do, the invasion of Afghanistan anymore. We're not looking for a fight. We're looking to avoid a fight. And one of the reasons is that Iran has emerged as a very significant regional power with a tremendous amount of military capability. Iran is also a major player in the regional and global economy, and it's incumbent upon the United States to do what we can to stabilize this economy, to make sure that it doesn't go south, especially in an election year, where the old James Carville mantra, it's the economy, stupid, factors in so large. So we don't want a war or a conflict with Iran that could lead to the shutting down of the Strait of Hormuz. This would have a devastating impact on global energy security. Oil prices would go through the roof at a time, again, to remind people, when Joe Biden has lowered the Strategic Petroleum Reserve down to less than 17 days worth of reserves. So if there was suddenly a shutdown in oil, transit, we'd be in trouble, huge trouble, in an election year, which is huge for Joe Biden. So what I'm trying to say is a long way of saying that there's a lot of reason to believe the reporting that's put out by Pepe Escobar. And again, when I say believe the reporting, I'm not challenging Pepe Escobar.
I understand.
I'm saying that every journalist has sources, and some sources are better than others. But what I'm saying is my assessment of the information that Pepe is reporting from the source would be that this is extraordinarily plausible, that it makes sense that this would indeed happen.
That was my takeaway, whether it was Bill Burns or whether it was, Mr. Burns from whatever that cartoon is. I was really focused more on the point that there was a dialogue between the United States and the parties involved, and that those parties came to a consensus. In fact, when I read, it was Thursday, that Iran had seized an Iranian cargo ship in the Straits of Hormuz. Then there was the missile launching, and then that drones were used as the kind of foray or entree into all of this, and that the drones traveled as far as they did. I said, oh, well, Iran was really sending a message more than they were an attack. And I think the message was and is, if you're looking for trouble, you found it, and you found a very big bag of it. And you really don't want to mess around with this. It seems as though the Biden administration is starting to get that message. I don't know that Netanyahu, I think it seems like it's falling on deaf ears in Israel.
What Iran did here is, I have said that I've called it one of the most impressive military victories in modern history.
In fact, let me interrupt and say, folks, you need to read Scott's piece, The Missiles of April. You can find it in Consortium News. Scott, you can tell me where else, but it's a phenomenal assessment of what recently transpired. Scott Ritter.
Well, thank you very much. It was originally put out on my Substack. It's scottritterextra.com. But then Joe Loria, who I have a very good relationship, he's the editor of Consortium News, asked permission to publish it with Consortium News. And then he and I had a discussion, and he asked some questions, follow-on questions based upon the article, and I gave him some answers. So he added some material. So for anybody who read my article on my Substack, there's additional material in on the Consortium News variant.
It's a great piece.
You might want to read that as well. It's just basically an update. You know, when you write things about moving targets, such as breaking news, you know, you write based upon the data that's available. And in the time between I published on my Substack and I spoke with Joe Loria, there was additional information necessary that provided additional clarity to some of the points I made. So it's not that I changed anything in terms of my assessments, although that's possible too. When you get new information, assessments can change. They should change, and you shouldn't be afraid to change them. But my assessment regarding the efficacy of the Iranian attack remains the same. One of the most impressive military victories in time. Now, people say, well, wait a minute, how could that be? They didn't blow up Israel. They didn't destroy anything. War is an extension of politics by other means. That's what everybody needs to understand. Military victories basically mean that you have achieved something through the use of military force. That's impressive, especially an impressive military victory. What Iran did on April 14th, on April 13th, 14th, in this attack, is establish deterrence supremacy over Israel. Iran has had a problem with what I would say making the world understand its declaratory policy regarding deterrence, its deterrence strategy. Deterrence is basically a policy posture that says, if you want to hit me, understand that I'm going to come in afterwards and pummel you to death, that the price you're going to pay for hitting me is going to be so great that you don't want to hit me. I'm not threatening to hit you first. I'm sitting here saying live and let live. But if you attack me, the price you're going to pay will be so overwhelming that it won't be worth what you thought you were going to achieve by hitting me in the first place. Iran has established this deterrence superiority over the United States. We saw that when the United States assassinated Qasem Soleimani in 2020. The Iranians responded with a missile attack against the Al-Asad air base that didn't kill any Americans. It was telegraphed well in advance. Mm-hmm. But the purpose was to demonstrate the Americans that we can reach out and touch you anywhere, anytime, with devastating force, and there's nothing you can do to stop this. Nothing you can do. So now we get to William Burns meeting with his Iranian counterparts, and when they say, and we will strike American bases, Burns is going, yeah, and they can. Mm-hmm. And if they do, there's nothing we can do to stop it, and we will suffer horrific losses. Therefore, Mr. President, we should heed what the Iranians are saying. This is deterrence superiority over the United States, that the United States understands the consequences of attacking Iran, is not willing to live with those consequences because they will be severe, even more so in an election year where any disruption of the economy is politically fatal to the incumbent seeking re-election. So they have successfully done that with the United States. Iran has also used missiles. Again, part of declaratory policy, it doesn't have to be necessarily spoken policy, but demonstrative. Mm-hmm. And we've seen Iran use missiles to strike targets in Iran, in Syria,
Pakistan. In fact, on that Pakistan point, that was about a month ago, maybe month and a half ago. And when I heard that Iran had sent, I think it was a cruise missile into Pakistan, I did my best to calculate how far that missile traveled. And then I checked, well, what's the distance between Tehran and Tel Aviv? It was about the same distance. And I said, I think Iran is sending a message to Israel that we can strike Tel Aviv if we so choose.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, just so people understand historically, during the Gulf War, and this not too many people know this, so Israel was very perturbed about Saddam Hussein's Scud missiles hitting Israeli cities and locations. And they were threatening direct military intervention, which would have destroyed the coalition that George W. Bush had built up. And so, you know, we were doing everything we could to convince the Israelis that we had the Scud problem under control,
And
pro-handle.
you mean that person, you were personally involved in doing that.
Yeah, no, this was my part of the war that I mean, first of all, I wasn't a general, I wasn't a colonel, I wasn't a lieutenant colonel, I wasn't a major, I was just a captain. But as a captain, I had I played a bigger role than one would normally expect from a captain. I mean, when my name gets briefed to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and when General Schwarzkopf not only fires me but arrests me because of what I'm doing, I'm having an impact larger than what I was wearing on my shoulder. And I'm pretty proud of the work I did during the Gulf War, but that's beside the point. The point is that Israel was being told, don't intervene because we've got it under control. But Israel needed to make a statement. And it was a statement being made not to Iraq, because what they did is they brought out a Jericho missile, which is a nuclear capable missile, but also can have conventional warheads. And they fired this missile into the Mediterranean Sea. And when you measure the distance that it went, it's exactly the distance from Israel to Baghdad. And what the Israelis were telling, not the Iraqis, because the Iraqis couldn't monitor the attack and it wasn't publicly announced, they were telling the Americans who were monitoring that if you don't solve this problem, we're going to solve it for you. And this is the weapon that we're going to use. And it was a wake-up call. I remember when that happened, we're all like, stop. We were only getting 2 hours sleep a night. No more sleep at night. Do everything you can to stop these Iraqi missiles from flying. We never did, but Israel stayed out of the war. But my point is, when you talk about, because to the layperson, they might be like, "Come on, Wilmer, you're getting a little too creative there, a little too
Oh.
conspiratorial."
I heard that. I heard that last Saturday night. I was at a buddy's house, and he said to me, I walk into his house and CNN is on as it always is, chirping in the background. And so finally he says to me, "So what do you think?" I said, "Think about what?" He said, "What do you think about the Iraq sending those?" I said, "Oh," I said, "Man, that was collaborated. That was done with collaboration." He said, "Man, you always come in here with this." With this junk. I said, "Well, okay." So I hear that a lot.
Well, but in this case, it's not junk, because I'm telling you, as somebody who has been in the technical analysis business of ballistic missiles for some time now, there are various ways to send a message. To give you an example, in the arms control world, sometimes the way to send a message is to open up telemetry channels that are normally closed down, and launch a missile test. You're not saying anything. You don't put out a press release, but the people monitor, because you don't want to say anything.
North
This is
Korea does this all the time.
all the time. They open up some telemetry channels and they just go, "Hey, psst, listen to this." And
And they send a missile into the Sea of Japan.
the technicians are going, "Uh-oh, they got. Oh, they did this capability. Oh no!" And then they're writing secret reports, and that message gets. Meanwhile, the public is just sitting there going to the beach, surfing, smoking dope, and doing whatever we do, because we are not meant to get upset about this or worried about it. It's a subtle message being sent to the intel to leadership through the intelligence agency. So your notion that the distance mattered, because Iran didn't need to fire at that distance. They just could have fired at a closer range, whatever. But to fire at that distance is a signal to the people who are that distance away that what we're doing here, we can do here. And but the problem is the Israelis weren't listening. This is the problem. Iran has, through very indirect and direct means, first of all, Iran has never issued a public declaratory policy on deterrence and ballistic missiles until now. And it's one of the weaknesses of Iran, is that they didn't make it clear what the consequences would be. The United States got it, because they hit us, and we're smart enough to go, "Oh, we don't want that again." Pakistan sort of gets it, But I mean, ISIS in Syria, when they got hit with missiles, you know, ISIS isn't going to sit there and go, oh, you're going to hit us with missiles, so we're not going to carry out terrorism anymore. No, that was a punitive attack. The same thing with the various missile strikes in Iraq. It was a punitive attack. It wasn't meant to be a declaratory policy statement. And so here you have a situation where Israel just isn't getting it, because Israel believes that it has deterrent supremacy over mm-hmm. Iran. And why would Israel believe that? I don't know. Maybe they've assassinated a whole bunch of Iranian scientists in Iran with no consequence. Maybe they've carried out covert direct action sabotage in Iran, blowing up nuclear-related facilities with no consequence. Maybe they've struck Iranian Revolutionary Guard Command positions in Lebanon, in Syria, in Iraq, inflicting casualties with no consequence. So maybe Israel believed that it had established deterrent supremacy over Iran. Therefore, when they saw a meeting at the Iranian consulate in Damascus of these major people plotting the next phase of the operations against Israel, they said, take it out. There won't be any consequence because the Iranians are afraid of us. The Iranians won't strike us because we have deterrent supremacy. Iran believes that if they attack us, we will come down on them tenfold. And so they struck the consulate, and Iran mm-hmm. went, guess what, guys? It's over. We're done with the subtlety. We warned you, don't attack our sovereign territory. The consulate is sovereign territory. We're going to respond. But now the problem with the Iranian response is you have to put yourself in the Iranian shoes, because the last thing Iran wants, it's just like the United States. They don't want a war with Israel. They don't want it.
As they said in The Godfather, it's bad for business.
It's bad for business. And business right now for Iran is improving. Mm-hmm. They have, you know, they're members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. China has brokered a rapprochement with Saudi Arabia, dismantling an American strategy of creating a Sunni shield against the Shia crescent and provoking permanent conflict that would empower American defense industry, Israeli security, credibility, and economic co-prosperity between that part of the world and Europe, with Israel in the middle. Israel's going, well, we're back in the game, guys. And Israel was, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu, for all the criticism that people have out there, and I'm one of his biggest critics, understand that on October 6th, he was on top of the world.
Mm-hmm.
On October 6th, he had created a geopolitical reality that had Israel normalizing relations with the Gulf Arab states, Israel becoming a major player in a major global economic enterprise, the India-Middle East Economic Corridor, mm-hmm. And the world not talking about a Palestinian state anymore. Israel was entering, it was becoming legitimate. It was like Michael Corleone in The Godfather when he was saying, I'm going to put all that behind me and I'm going to become legitimate.
Right.
Hamas reached out and just dragged them back in by October 7th. And then Israel was exposed for the criminal enterprise that it is. And now Israel is collapsed. But Iran, you know, that was the Israeli press. Iran is sitting here saying, We don't want a war. We're members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. We normalized relations with Saudi Arabia. We have an axis of resistance that's holding Israel in check and these plans. I mean, you know, Hezbollah is very strong. The militias in Iraq and Syria are strong. The Ansarallah movement in Yemen, the Houthi,
very
strong. But we don't want to provoke war. What we want is to become economically viable again. The promise that we, the theocracy, have made to the Iranian people over time, that trust us, things will get better. We're in that, you know, hey, you trusted us. Now things are about to get better. We're joining BRICS together with Saudi Arabia. So we're going to work with Saudi Arabia and these powerful economic interests that no longer are turning their backs on us to create, you know, economic opportunity. And the last thing Iran needed is a war with Israel.
It's bad for business.
It's bad for business. And so now the Iranians are like, how do we set declaratory policy to achieve deterrent supremacy? Superiority.
Mm-hmm.
Supremacy is where you have everybody just totally intimidated. Superiority mm-hmm. is where you put the thought in people's mind. And they now need to tell the Israelis, you can't attack us, or the price you're going to pay is tenfold. Normally you do that. I mean, it's like going in the boxing ring, Mike Tyson. Even now, I don't know if you've been watching his training videos of him getting ready for this fight he's got in July 20th. The man's a beast. I'm intimidated. If I could do 57, what he's doing.
Well, let me tell you, I don't know if you saw the report of the guy that was kicking the back of his seat on the airplane. And he came over. He kept asking the guy, "Hey, man, can you stop kicking my seat?" And the guy wouldn't leave him alone. And the folks on the plane said, finally, he came over the top of that seat like Iran and pummeled the guy. They had to carry the guy off the plane in a stretcher.
Well, see, that's deterrence supremacy.
There you go.
Deterrence supremacy is when I jump into the ring with Tyson and Tyson knocks my face in, kicks my teeth out, and I'm on the ground hospitalized.
And bites your ear.
Pardon?
And bite your ear.
That is a bonus, yes. But the deterrence superiority is where I jump in the ring and Tyson comes up, takes the fist right to my nose and just touches it. But he does it in a way that I'm in my stance, but he's already there. And I'm like, oh,
I got a problem.
Yeah, okay. I don't really want to be in this ring, Mike. It was a misunderstanding. I'm backing off. I'm just going to go out here and pee my pants in the parking lot. So that's what Iran needed to do. But how do you do this? It's a very delicate operation. That's why this was one of the most impressive military victories in modern history, because what Iran did was make all the demonstration necessary to show potential. And in the end, they hit a base, Nevatim. And this is important for your audience to understand. Mm-hmm. The Nevatim Air Base is the single most heavily protected spot on Earth when it comes to anti-ballistic missile defense. There's no spot on Earth that's better defended than Nevatim. It has at the heart of this defense and I'll give you a fancy name, ANTPY-2 X-band radar.
Not one, but two.
It's the number two radar, not two radars.
No, I said, because I got one over my house.
Yeah.
They got two.
2.0. This is 2.0.
Right. Yeah. Oh, man.
And so they got this radar there that has the ability to do over-the-horizon surveillance. But it's not just the radar, which is the most sophisticated radar of its type in the world. It's linked into the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization in the United States, Strategic Command, and the satellites that we have over hanging over the area. So all of that's linked in into a common command center that's shared with the Israelis. So this data is fed to the Israelis and around Nevatim. And why is Nevatim important? I don't know. The F-35I fighters are there. This is Israel's best fighter plane, their strategic deterrent. They have F-15s, F-16s, and they do other secret things there as well.
They were, because of the notice that they were given, if I understand it, they were able to move those F-35s. So again, it was coordinated.
100%. I mean, we'll get to that in a second.
Right. Okay.
But they have, the Arrow 2 and Arrow 3 missiles, which are joint Israeli-American projects, are deployed around Nevatim. David Sling, which is another anti-ballistic missile capability, is deployed around Nevatim. Advanced Patriot missiles are deployed around Nevatim. And the U.S. THAAD system is deployed around Nevatim. The bottom line is they have, and there's Iron Dome as well. And so what they have is this multi-layered defense using the world's best anti-ballistic missile technology linked to the world's best surveillance and tracking technology. And you read the literature on this stuff. We hit a bullet with a bullet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, wow, you guys are good. Now, here's the other thing. It's all specifically tailored for one threat and one threat only. Iranian medium-range ballistic missiles. That's all it's geared to do. It's not like there's confusion. It's not like they have a multitude of missions. One mission, Iranian medium-ranged missiles. Okay, so now that's like me watching Mike Tyson training videos. And I'm watching the training, and I'm like, I got him. I can move. I got this, guys. I got this. I go into training, bam, bullet hit a bullet. I got this. And so now Mike Tyson, Iran, they go a step further. Not only do they do the Pepe Escobar advance notice, they build the attack in a way that says, hey, this is really happening. They announce the launch of the drones. And These aren't just any drones, guys. These are slow moving, loud drones. So you couldn't get a better air alarm system than what Iran gave Israel. They unleash the drones and hear the drones go. Now Israel's got
they're like flying bumblebees. Yeah.
6 hours of advance notice, which gives the United States time to say, take your F-35s out, anything valuable. But the other thing the Iranians did is they told the United States, see, I think they went a step further. The Iranians made it clear that they will only strike military targets that were related to the action. Because Iran's whole argument, and again, I know in the West, we tend to roll our eyes.
Mm-hmm.
Like when Russia says we acted in Ukraine based upon Article 51, self-defense, preemptive self-defense, the Caroline Doctrine, all the people who hate Russia go, no, that was a brutal roar of aggression, unprovoked. No, the Russians actually have a cognizable legal case. Mm-hmm. Because that's how Russia operates, based upon the rule of law. Now, the rule of law, Wilmer, as we all know, can be bent, twisted, manipulated. I'm not saying that, you know, the Russians have the perfect case. What I'm saying is the case that Russia's made is cognizable under law.
It's defendable.
You could take it to a court and it's not going to be tossed out as
it's not Tony Blinken's rules-based order.
It is not. And so now the Iranians, they have been attacked and they have cited Article 51 of the UN Charter as their justification. But now you can't claim to be, you know, hiding behind the law and then just totally break the law yourself.
Mm-hmm.
If Iran had come
you can if you're the United States.
Correct. But that's the rules-based international
order. Okay.
Not the law-based international order. Okay. That's the difference between the two. The rules say we can do whatever we want. The law says, no, you're constrained by the law. So in order to justify self-defense, Iran had to limit its retaliation to the immediate threat that was posed by those who attacked them, which means you can hit the two air bases where the airplanes flew out. And there's a third site that nobody's talking about yet.
Is that the CIA site?
Well, it's the 8200, the SIGINT site on Golan Heights that's looking out into Damascus. And according to the Iranians, that's the site that gathered the intelligence about the Iranians being in the consulate, and then shared that intelligence with the airplanes coming in. And so these three targets are the three. Now, in addition to that, Iran is allowed to strike facilities and locations that are involved in the defense of these three things. So the ballistic missile defense capability becomes a legitimate target. But now, so Iran has to hit these three. And so they've broadcast it. We're coming. And that gives the United States to do something politically smart, which is to tell the Israelis, we will defend you, but we will not participate in any Israeli counterattack. So we've limited the scope and scale of our participation in this. And so we came together, we started shooting down these drones, creating a fiction of Iranian incompetence, Iranian lack of capability. So this is part of the plan. This is all part of the plan. Now, Iran didn't sit down with the United States and say, this is what we're going to do. This is what we want you to do. Iran is scripting it for them. I mean, this is basically the United States going, damn, I forgot my lines. And Iran's going, here you go. Here come the drones. Shoot them down. Oh, yeah. Okay, thank you. And so we're shooting it down. And then we're sending the cruise missiles. Just in case you don't know, we're launching them live on TV. Here, let me show you a close-up of what they look like so you understand the operational parameters of the system. And off go the cruise missiles.
Don't shoot pigeons. Shoot cruise missiles.
So now they're shooting. But then as they're doing this, the Iranians are sitting there going, okay, so we sent the drones. What's lighting up, guys? First of all, what people don't understand is before all this happened, the Iranians did a very targeted cyber attack and shut down. They attacked the Iron Dome system. Now, why do you want to attack the Iron Dome system but not attack the others? Because the Iron Dome system isn't designed to take down big ballistic missiles. It's designed to take down the other stuff.
Medium-range cruise missiles.
No, well, cruise missiles and drones, low-flying. Okay. It's actually designed to take down Katyusha rockets and Hamas rockets.
Okay.
That's what it's supposed to do. So you disrupt this so that the other systems have to take priority. And then the Iranians are going, oh, thank you very much. Now, some of the drones that were sent in aren't armed with explosives, but armed with radars and signals intelligence collection, which they're broadcasting the data back to Iran. These guys are very sophisticated, ladies and gentlemen. These aren't amateurs you're dealing with. And they're sending in going, here they come, turn it on, collect, thank you. And now they have their targeteers looking at a big map going, okay, we got a radar here, we got here. Okay, now they're shooting. Oh, okay, we got missile launchers here, boom, boom, boom. It's all there. Then, and they've looked at it all. Then they say, okay, remember, because the goal now is to get the glove to touch the nose.
Mm-hmm.
The goal isn't to hit the knockout. So they say, what do we need to do to demonstrate capability? The Iranians used, now there's some mixed reporting out here. The problem is, you know, I, like everybody else, I'm held hostage to what the Iranians, I don't get to go on the ground anymore and look at the debris and do technical analysis. I used to do that. And I used to be able to come back. One of the things we did with the Iraqis, just so people understand, I'm not the dumbest Marine in the world. I'm one of the dumbest Marines in the world, but I do have some capability based upon experience. And during my time as a weapons inspector, I worked with the Israelis, their technical intelligence people, on looking at debris of the missiles that Iraq fired against Israel. And we were able to ascertain several different variants of Scud missiles that have different capabilities that the Iraqis had been denying or not declaring. And by coming back to them with the technical, intelligence from the debris on the ground, the Iraqis had to admit to certain capabilities that they had been denying. And this is important when you're trying to be able to stand before the world and say, we understand the total picture of Iraqi ballistic missile capability, and we can certify that we can account for it all. Because imagine going before the Security Council and saying that, only to have the Israelis go, yes, but what about variant 3D Alpha 4? Well, I don't understand what you're talking about. What's 3D Alpha 4? That's the point. You're making a report and you don't understand what we're talking about, which means you don't know everything, do you? I don't like to be in that position as an expert I want to know everything. And so we did, and we got the Iraqis to come clean. So when I say we could account for Iraq's ballistic missile program, we could account for every aspect of it. So I don't get to do that right now. So I'm at a disadvantage where I have to rely upon information. So I don't know if Iran used their hypersonic missiles or not. I don't know that.
Okay.
There's reports that
it is reported.
There's reports that they did, and then there's reports that they didn't. Okay. And it's conflicting. The most recent Press TV report, and Press TV is a organ of the Iranian state, says that they did use the Fatah 2 missiles against the Nevatim airfield. So I'm going to run with that, but I want to put a big caveat on that I don't know for sure. Okay. But we do know, just looking at the characteristics of the missiles that came in, that they used at least three different kinds they used more than that, but three that were designed to put the glove on the nose. Other missiles that were sent were designed to be shot down, again, as part of the intelligence collection process. So you send in an older ballistic missile that comes on a ballistic missile trajectory. The first thing that you do by doing that is you are training the defense systems. These Iranians are smart. They understand these things. You're training them because, you see, there's a whole bunch of computers, software, artificial intelligence. This is the proof that AI, please don't do it. Better than AI is the brain. Trained brain. Because AI, listen to what everybody's talking about. I get this phone call. I don't know if you get this up. Scott, I'd like to take the transcripts of your discussions and use them to train my AI. I don't know if you've ever received that kind of request.
Yes.
All right. And I'm like, no, I don't want you to do that. I just personally don't. But the point is, that's how AI, it's not artificial intelligence, ladies and gentlemen. It's just programmed. Just programmed in a different way. And you can program in stupidity, which the Iranians
said. They usually do.
Let's program in stupidity.
Well, for example, that's why facial recognition technology fails to the degree that it does. It's limited by the abilities and capabilities of the people that are programming it. That's why facial recognition technology doesn't work on Asian people, and it doesn't work on people of color.
So you're, damn it, I'm the wrong race.
I could have heard that a long time ago. Go ahead. But,
touche. but the yeah, so the Iranians are programming the AI. They're sending missiles in, and the system is starting to, you know, to normalize, to come up with us, because it's wartime now. So now you're actually detecting, tracking, and firing. Then what you do is you throw in, it's like a pitcher, fastball, changeup. And here comes the changeup. First changeup they do is, and I don't know the sequence that they did this, but we see the video evidence. There's a warhead that comes in, and again, it's about timing. So you're sending these missiles in. Now they have separating warheads. So what happens when a missile has a separating warhead is the radar is picking one target. Mm-hmm. Most of the radar is dealing with two targets, but it's not just two targets. When you separate the warhead from the missile body starts to tumble and it starts sending differentiating signals, and it's no longer a ballistic trajectory. So the computer's going, oh my God, what's happening here? Meanwhile, this warhead's going this way. It's tracking that, and it has to make a decision. Which one? This one. Pick this warhead. So now they've trained it to discriminate onto this warhead, which is what they want. Now you'd say, why would they want to look at that warhead? You'll find out. The warhead comes in and they're timing. It's like a track coach. Got the timer. Warhead comes in and the missiles fire up to hit it. And you go, we got it. We now know what the release point is for the missiles being fired. So now they send in this other missile. It comes in, warhead separates. The AI says, go with the warhead, baby. They ignore this thing, which is good because it's just a distraction. They're focused on the warhead. They're on the clock. Everything's getting queued up just the way it's supposed to be. Everything's optimized. We're going to take this thing. A bullet hits a bullet, baby. And all of a sudden, the warhead, right before the launch on the ground, fires off a whole bunch of decoys. It's like a shotgun shell. And the computer goes, damn, what the hell just happened? We don't know. It's going crazy trying to differentiate between all this stuff. And they're firing a whole bunch of missiles now because they're in panic overload. And they're trying to deal with this. And meanwhile, they have a warhead here because they accelerated these shotgun shells out. So they're going faster now. The computer's adapting to that. Oh, God, what do we do? Fire, fire, fire. That warhead's hanging back. It's not the priority right now. And then once everything's committed, you see it on the film. Boom, it has a booster engine on it. It gets fired through the chaff. Nothing's intercepting it. Bam, hits the ground. But not only that, as it comes in, it makes an adjustment. I don't know if people saw that. It comes in and you see it go up, up again. Terminal adjustment to hit the precise target it wanted to hit. Iran sent a couple of those in. And they took out the Iron Dome sites, etc. A signal. Just gotcha. Gotcha. And they know that the Israelis are smart. They know there's a bunch of Israeli guys who are smarter than I am that I used to work with who are looking at all this stuff going, oh, God, they got us. They got us. Damn. Now we come to Nevatim, and it's the same thing. They send in the missiles. This is the most heavily layered system in the world. They send in the missiles, and this one's not even as sophisticated. It just comes in. They release it, hyper-accelerates down in. Wham, hits the ground. And the Israelis, because the Israelis are like, okay, we got it. We don't have it. it's like a catcher used to catching 70-mile-an-hour fastballs.
And it hits him in the head.
And then the guy fires the 102-mile-an-hour one. Bam, what happened? I wasn't ready for that. It comes in and it hits it.
Well, now, ketchup called a changeup and a fastball came through.
Fastball came in. So then they came into Nevatim and they touched Nevatim at least five times. The Iranians are saying seven times. I would probably go with five. And the reason why I say this is that there is a chance. It's the most heavily defended space on Earth. There's a chance that they got two of them. I'm going to concede that point to the Israelis and the Americans that you put all these hundreds of billions of dollars into building something and you got two out of seven, but five hit. But the idea, none of them were meant to be a knockout blow. Each one was just a, hey, hey, hey. And the Israelis know that. They're sitting there going, and now they've come to the realization, and this is the whole point. After all of this, the Israelis have come to the realization that Iran can reach out and touch us anytime it wants to, any place it wants to, and there's nothing we can do to stop them. So now the Israelis are in a quandary because Iran has War is an extension of politics by other means. So Iran has established a political reality using military means to establish a deterrence superiority without creating the conditions that mandate an automatic Israeli response. You see, they've allowed the situation to be a narrative to be developed by the United States and Israel that says, Iran sucks. They sent everything in there. We shot it all down. We're better than they are. We actually established deterrence over Iran by telling the Iranians that no matter what they do, you came, thought you were Mike Tyson. You came in and swang, gave us all your punches. You missed, you missed, you missed, you missed, you missed. We're still, it's like Ali. I'm still here. You didn't touch me. You punched yourself out. Can't touch this. That's the narrative that Iran was allowing the West to do. But the reality, though, is that the Israelis got down there. And there was an interesting text. I don't know if you saw it by a post by an Israeli insider who has connectivity with the War Council. And he said, if the Israeli public heard what was being said in the War Council, 4 million people will be leaving Israel right now. I'm going to tell you right now what was said in the War Council. Iran can destroy us. Iran can flatten us. There's nothing we can do. If we allow this to happen, to remain unanswered, we've lost everything that we've fought for over the past several decades. This deterrence supremacy that we thought we had is gone forever. Nobody will ever respect us. Nobody will ever fear us. And therefore, people will attack us and we'll be in an untenable situation. So
that's very important politically. Because that is part of the whole Zionist ideology is we're the persecuted people, and you all need us to protect you because the wolves are always at the door. Yep. And now what is the reality is all that insurance money you've been paying for those insurance policies, you've wasted your money.
Absolutely. You know, I used to live in Turkey. And when I would travel through the plains of Turkey, they have shepherds with their flocks. Mm-hmm. And out there amongst the flocks are the Anatolian sheepdogs. I don't know if you've ever seen a picture of an Anatolian sheepdog.
Yes. Yes. I'm a big dog guy. Yes.
Okay. So these are like bears.
Right.
Some of them are bigger than bears. And I remember we were walking once in a Kurdish village, and we got too close to the sheep, and all of a sudden these two things coming at us, and they're bigger than we are. I mean, these are bigger than humans, and they're coming at us, and they're going to kill us. And we knew that. It was just all over. And then you hear, and the shepherd gives whatever signal, and the sheepdogs stop, and then they come up and they sit down, and you pet them. They have no ears because their ears have been chewed off. Their noses are scars. Their faces, they got these giant collars with spikes on them to protect their throat. Their faces are like that because they fight wolves. Mm-hmm. They hold the wolves off. Israel has been telling the world that we are the Anatolian sheepdog. We are here and we will protect you. Mm-hmm. You, the rest of the world, the sheep from the wolves. They're getting ready. What Iran just did is went, took off the cloak and went, you're just a sheep. You're just a sheep. We are the wolves. You're just a sheep. And the sheep's going, I don't want everybody to know this. We were faking them out that we were the Anatolian sheepdog, but we're really just a sheep. So that's a political problem for the Israelis. And this is important. And this is probably the most important part of this discussion, believe it or not. This isn't about Israeli security. This isn't about a real threat. Because Iran is a responsible nation. When Iran talks about deterrence,
security, wait a minute now, Scott. Now you've crossed the Rubicon.
Ooh.
Israel, Iran is responsible.
Yeah, Iran is.
They're ravaging crazy ragheads. Come on, Scott.
Well, that may be true, but they're ravaging crazy ragheads who operate based upon a law-based system.
Right.
As opposed to a rule-based system.
Not only that, a law-based system that is based on thousands of years of history and culture.
Right. I mean, that's their own national culture. I mean, a lot of people go the theocracy. Yes, but Persian. Understand that this is a civilized people who have been around.
They invented cataract surgery.
They invented a lot of stuff.
They invented the agrarian watering system.
The irrigation
system. Yeah. They invented the wheel, I think.
They probably did.
Go ahead.
We've been reinventing the wheel over time, but
mathematics, psychology,
the whole thing,
sociology,
yeah,
all comes out of there.
And today you see it. You know, when you Google, International Math Olympics, the teams that are coming in at top are Chinese teams and Iranian teams. MIT, California Technology Institute, they're coming in, you know, down at the bottom. They're not winning this thing.
Behind IIT, the Indian Institute of Technology.
And, yeah, the Indians are getting up there too. They have good applied science, right, and good applied skills. And it's not just that. I mean, to give you an example, the Iranians have the highest percentage of peer-reviewed PhD theses published per year. So it's not like, excuse me, Iraq, forgive me for this, but under Saddam Hussein, where you went to an Iraqi university, it used to have a good reputation, but they were just handing out diplomas to Uday, Qusay, and the thugs, mm-hmm, who went in there and said, I went to school, here's your diploma, see, I'm a doctor. No, in Iran, you earn it. You go to the school, you earn it, and you earn it the old-fashioned way, peer-reviewed, which means your thesis leaves Iran, goes out amongst the world, the experts, they review it, they come back, and they say, this is PhD level work.
I just had a conversation with another dear friend, and we, when you look at their diplomats, when you look at their leadership, many of them are engineers.
Yeah.
President Ahmad, the first time I went to Iran, I got to sit for 2 hours with then former President Ahmadinejad. Man has a PhD in engineering and teaches engineering at the University of Tehran.
Yeah.
I sat there for 2 hours listening to this cat going, oh my God.
Yeah, he's not what he was sold
is deep.
Yeah.
No. He's not some short madman.
Oh.
He's a short, brilliant man.
A brilliant madman, maybe, but the point is,
he brilliant was dude,
genius. No, they're all that way. They all have extraordinary. First of all, let's stop picking on ayatollahs. If people understood what it took to become an ayatollah in Iran, the level of a seminarian, study, what you have to know, not mm-hmm. just about. And here's the important thing about the Shia theocracy. And for all the Shia people out there, if I got this wrong, please forgive me, but it's my understanding, especially in the Iranian model. They have something called the marja, which is basically your flock, mm-hmm. what do they call it? A diocese in the Catholic Church,
yeah,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Congregation.
Thank you. There's what we want. Congregation. It's your mm-hmm. congregation. Now you have to, because in Iran, it's not just about knowing the religion, but having a philosophy that is derived from absolute understanding of the religion that is approachable to the people. It is religious democracy, because now I've done my Ayatollah training and they go, Hama, I can't do the cross, sir. God, I just made a huge mistake. Forgive me. But they anoint you. They say, you're the dude. You're the guy that can do it. But now to survive, you have to write a document that says, this is my religious philosophy as it applies to something today. There's a name for that, the Talmud or something. I apologize. But they put that out there. Now people read it, the mm-hmm. public, it's there for the public. The people go, I like this guy. I'm going to hang out in his marja for a little bit and see what he does. Now, if they come to the marja and he's not impressive, then the marja dissipates and they shut him down. They say, you failed. You couldn't win the people. It's not just about imposing religion on people. It's about getting the people to buy into what you're saying religiously.
That's what the Ayatollah Khomeini was doing when he was in exile in France.
Bingo.
Yep. Okay.
And you have, but you have compete, for instance, Sistani in Iraq. He has a competing, the Najaf marges compete with the Qom marges that compete with, Karbala, which compete with, there's competing marges. And even within Qom, there's different marges.
I'm drawing a blank on the guy in Iraq that was raising all kind of hell.
Muqtadir al-Sadr.
There you go.
Yeah.
Who is the son, if I have it right? He's the son of
and he, in order to become credible, had to go to Qom and study and learn things. Everybody was, when he was out there talking, he had a lot of personality, he had the name, mm-hmm. but people are going, you don't have the credentials, man. You can't sit here and play religion because we take our religion seriously. So he had to go disappear and go to Qom and train up.
Right.
And all that.
Had to coach him up a little bit.
But he also then has to go out and sell himself.
Right.
To an audience. And a lot of people weren't buying what he was selling. I mean, he's a very popular man, very, very influential in Iraqi politics today, but it's earned. It's not given. But the point is the Iranians are a responsible nation. Mm-hmm. And if Israel was smart, they would have said, okay, we're in a bad position here. Bad position. It's not a good position for us to be in. We need to take a step back, take advantage of the fact that the Iranians have written a script that makes it believable that we did some amazing stuff. And then we have to reassess where we are. What do we have to do to get our defenses back up? What do we have to do to get capabilities to strike Iran? When do we want to do it? Because the United States isn't on our side right now. What do we, behavioral modification to get the world to love us again, things of this nature, strategic thinking.
Right.
But Israel's governed by a crazy man named Benjamin Netanyahu, who doesn't care about Israel. He doesn't care about the Israeli people. He doesn't care about Israeli security. He doesn't care about alliances with the United States. He's a 76-year-old man in bad health who only cares about Benjamin Netanyahu. And he right now has his butt in a sling because he got embarrassed on October 7th. And now he was just humiliated by the Iranians. And he can only stay in power as a wartime prime minister. And if he, they're going to, either they have to ratchet it up in Gaza. Every Israeli knows that they lost in Gaza, that they haven't won. Peretz, the day before the Iranian attack, front page headline, we lost. We lost everything. We haven't won anything. We've lost. And that's the assessment of the Israeli intelligence service.
And people who don't know need to know that Haaretz is a very prominent Israeli newspaper.
With a very good reputation of...
you said good reputation. I was about to compare it to
the New York Times. Used to have.
Right. There you go. There you go.
They used to have.
Right.
But so he's lost in Gaza. He was looking to maybe promote a conflict in against Hezbollah to expand the war. And there's always that hope that we can drag the United States into a larger war with Iran. But the United States says, no, we're not doing that. Hezbollah now is linked to Iranian deterrence superiority. So you can't do the Hezbollah thing like you wanted to do anymore.
And now you've got Ansar Allah in the Red Sea, shutting down the Red Sea.
Shutting down the Israeli economy.
And on the other side, you have Iran shutting down the Strait of Hormuz. And that's why I go back to that ship that they captured, because they wanted the United States to understand this will shut future. Your oil off.
Right. And the United States, remember, we've been running Guardian Prosperity or something like that, whatever the name of our wonderfully named operation to deter the Houthi. And I don't know if everybody understands, we had to approach the Houthi last week and beg them to stop it. Please, 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 please. We'll stop bombing you. We'll do everything. We'll lift the terrorism thing, but just stop this, please, because we can't force you to stop it. And the Houthi went, they said, here's another one. The missiles you guys are deterring. That's a failure. But that's the thing. The failure of deterrence policy has been played out with the Houthi, and it's being played out. See, America no longer has deterrence superiority. We no longer have deterrence. We can't deter.
Wait a minute. Anybody. We sent the Eisenhower into now. This takes me back to. So we sent we sent a couple aircraft carrier groups into the region when I think it was the Eisenhower. Oh, it was Gerald Ford.
I think we
first sent the Gerald Ford in. President Putin says to Joe Biden, why did you do that? You're not scaring anybody. These people don't scare. And oh, by the way, we can sink your carrier from here with our Kinjal missile, hypersonic missile. So yeah. Stop it, Joe. You're not scaring anybody.
But here's something else that happened. And I'm glad you brought this up because this is an important thing. The United States linked at least two of its ships to this system. And this is part of the American anti-ballistic missile strategy. We do this with Japan. We do this with Korea. We do this with Europe. We have a whole bunch of Aegis class destroyers in Spain that we now are going to fan out to protect Europe from Russian missiles. And we're telling everybody, don't worry, we got this. We got this. Remember, guys, when that satellite was coming down, we shot it down. We're that good. We can bullet hit a bullet, you know, kind of stuff. So we went to the Israelis and we plugged in to the world's most sophisticated anti-ballistic missile shield in the world. We plugged in and the Iranians went, oh. What the Iranians proved, and this is, I just want this to sink in there, they can hit any American ship anytime they want with a warhead that will sink that ship. They just sent a signal to the United States that we will sink every one of your aircraft carriers. We will sink every one of your destroyers, all these wonderful ships you have. You can't stop it. The missile we sent in and touched Nevatim can sink any one of your ships. And how do we know? Because you plugged your ships into the system, guys. Up until then, we might have been theoretical about this. But now you plugged it in and you were playing the game. You committed your best anti-missile ships to the defense system and you didn't stop us. We went in and went pop, 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 pop five times on the target. If Nevatim had become the Gerald Ford or become the Eisenhower or the Carl Vinson, we would have sunk that ship. That's the other thing that the Iranians did here that nobody's talking about, because this is the scariest thing in the world to the United States. Iran just told the United States, your Navy is useless, useless. It's done. And now, but it's not just the Iranians, the North Koreans.
China has...
Everybody out there who has hypersonic missile capability is now basically saying, oh, yeah, we can sink American ships, too. And this is another thing.
I was talking to KJ No last week, and KJ was talking about the United States sending all kind of hardware into Taiwan and that the United States may even wind up sending personnel into Taiwan. And in anticipation of China making a land invasion in Taiwan. And I said, KJ, why would China do that when all they got to do is sink an aircraft carrier with a hypersonic missile? And he said, well, that's a good point.
No, I mean, the United States, but now we come to, you know, because America's facing the same problem that Bibi Netanyahu is, except there's not a political dimension to it. Bibi Netanyahu right now has to do something to stay in power politically.
Right.
So now
and not be prosecuted for theft.
Correct. For his corruption. Yeah.
Right. Corruption.
The second he leaves office, he gets arrested and he gets put on trial.
A la Donald Trump.
Except, yeah, I mean, yeah.
I mean, that's a whole nother story, but I'm just saying that right now is what Donald Trump is facing.
Correct.
And I'm not saying it's legitimate or not legitimate.
That's my only reason why I did that is I don't want to get into the
it's happening.
Because Netanyahu is a criminal. He is right. A corrupt person. Donald Trump is an imperfect human being who may have committed some crimes, but in America, you're innocent until proven guilty. Right. And he has these trials, many of which people believe are politicized, designed, right. And diminishes. So
we can move on.
Right. We don't need to go down that rabbit hole on this episode.
Right.
But the fact is, Israel right now is desperately looking for a face-saving way out of this, because the fiction of we were so good that we stopped this Iranian attack is not believable.
Mm-hmm.
It's not believable domestically. So now the Israelis are looking for the ability to do something that, if not gives them deterrence superiority, they're looking for right now deterrence parity. parity. And so here's the question, because you remember, now we come back to Pepe, and this is probably a good way to spin this around. William Burns met with the Iranians beforehand and came up with an elegant solution to an extraordinarily difficult and dangerous problem. Iran now has established a deterrence philosophy, and they articulate, the second Israeli airplanes take off, we launch our missiles. We're not waiting for Israel to attack us. The second your planes take off, we're firing.
Iran has said, we consider the matter settled.
We consider
the matter over. You struck us, we struck back, let it go.
Correct. But it's not settled.
Right.
Because there's a thing called politics.
Right.
And the Iranians, again, are some of the most sophisticated political players in the world. So my guess is, as we're speaking, hey, Pepe, if you're out there, call your source. I'm giving you a hint. The behavioral patterns, because that's one thing I used to do as an intelligence officer, is do analysis and assessments, predictive analysis, based upon behavioral patterns. Humans tend to repeat behavioral patterns. And so now the CIA and the Iranians have talked to prevent one crisis. They're talking right now. And the CIA saying, guys, what can we do to prevent Israel from doing something really stupid, which is the big attack?
Right.
Which politically, we need a safety valve. This is the equivalent of a methane tank getting heat on it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a safety valve that goes, it's going to blow. So how do we get a safety valve? What can Israel do to save face that doesn't impact you? And you see the Israelis now ratcheting it down. It was, we're going to strike nuclear facilities, we're going to strike this, we're going to strike that. And now they're saying, well, what if we strike something outside of Iran, but it's clearly Iran?
Like a 7-Eleven.
Yeah. At 3 a.m. when it's been closed and nobody's there.
We're going to strike a 7-Eleven.
And so they're desperately looking for this outlet. The question now is, what will Iran do? My bet is that Iran will facilitate a face-saving gesture by Israel, because the Iranians don't want and don't need
a major war. Right.
And so
business.
It's horribly. The Iranian foreign ministry, just so everybody understands this, their number one priority now, or one of their top priorities, is they have all of their smart people right now writing papers for the BRICS summit in October, which Iran will be attending and will be playing a major role in establishing new global infrastructure and institutions on how the world's going to be governed.
And a possible international currency off of the dollar.
Bingo. These are big ticket things.
Business.
They don't need to be business. They don't need to be dragged into this stupidity of, you know, a mafia family dispute.
Really quickly, one of the reasons why President Putin went into Ukraine light in the beginning was he doesn't want a war because it's bad for his economy.
But the West didn't pick up on that.
Nope.
Now we got this thing.
And now he's kicking ass and taking names, and folks are all befuddled. Hey, you went looking for trouble. You found a big bag of it. And now, thank you for your time, Scott. Two things I want to hit quickly. One is the estimates are, in very simple terms, that Iran spent $1 million on this attack, and Israel lost $1 billion in their response to it.
I'd say $60 million for the Iranians, about $3.2 billion for the Israelis and the United States altogether.
Okay. And this other thing, is it Velvet or Violet? This AI program that Israel has developed that they assign a score. Are you familiar with this? They assign a score to Palestinians based upon a number of predetermined social behaviors. And when your score gets close to 100, you get assassinated. And this is all generated by artificial intelligence. You mentioned AI, so I wanted just to quickly drop that one in there before we get out.
No, I mean, again, it's a criminal enterprise. It's about killing innocents. And part of this AI, too, is that it calculates The number of civilian casualties that'll be assigned to that thing.
Target.
And unfortunately, for the Palestinians, one would think if you're a rational, look, I keep telling people I'm not a pacifist. And if you want to go to war, I'm old.
You're
now,
the guy.
But guys, I have no problem killing you. I mean, I know you're trying to kill me, so I will kill you. And I'm not going to weep at night when you die because you wanted to play this game. But I'm not in the business of killing you and taking out innocent civilians. Okay, that's where I draw the line. Now there's collateral damage. If it happens, I'll be upset. But I have my parameters. If I'm going to take you and they're saying you're going to take out this many civilians, I'm going, that's a bad target, not the right time, not the right place. We're not going to do it. The Israelis have the opposite thing. It's not just when you're going to take out the target, but when you get the maximum impact of civilian casualties. The Israeli approach, this AI program, is designed to kill the maximum number of family members and civilians to maximize the impact of the attack on the morale of the Palestinian people. But see, that's where AI fails, because it doesn't understand the human heart and doesn't understand rage. It doesn't understand hate. And they don't understand that the more Palestinians you kill, the more you train them to hate you. And not only that, the world is turning against you. See, the AI program hasn't figured out the global factor that every time they do this, the world hates Israel even more.
Hamas is a political organization. Hamas is a military organization. Hamas is an ideology. Yep. And you don't kill an ideology with weapons. Nope. You defeat an ideology with a better ideology,
which is generally linked to a better lifestyle, better standard of living, economic prosperity. Again, James Carville's mantra: "It's the economy, stupid." Isn't just an American only. It's a global human reality
about the way of life and quality of life.
Yeah.
Scott Ritter, my man, as always, thank you so much for joining me today. Greatly, greatly, greatly appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. It was an honor and a privilege.
Thank you, folks, so much for listening to the Connecting the Dots podcast with me, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Stay tuned for new episodes every week. Also, please, please follow and subscribe. Go to Patreon. Please contribute, because this is not cheap to do. Leave a review. Please share the show. Follow us on social media. You can find all of the links and all of the information in the show description. And remember, this is where the analysis of politics, culture, and history converge. Talk without analysis is just chatter, and we don't chatter here on Connecting the Dots. See you next time. Until then, I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. Have a great one. Peace.
Connecting the Dots with Dr. Wilmer Leon, where the analysis of politics, culture, and history converge.